Pervert.
Picard.
Pervert, bitch.
The weird circle plans. In this cave, restless sea, we are meant to call from out of the past stories, strange and weird.
That scares the hell out of me.
Welcome to the Two Girls True Crime Podcast. This is Katie.
And this is Courtney.
Just two girls talking murder, true crime, and other phenomena.
Bellkeeper, toll the bell so that all may know we are gathered again in the Weird Circle.
Today we're going to be discussing the Sherry Papini case from Redding, California. The one that was gone for 22 days and resurfaced on Thanksgiving, November 24th, 2016. As everyone has probably heard about this case, we're going to be talking about a few things that you may not have heard, including her blog post that has been talked about and so forth. And we're also going to give our thoughts on the case, whether it's a hoax or if she was really kidnapped. And we'd love to hear from you.
Or get rich quick scheme, people have been saying.
Yeah, people have been saying it is it's a simple get-rich scheme. So,
but to go through all that trouble.
To go through all of that trouble and to beat, I mean, her nose was broken. So you'd have to take a good beating. I mean, hey.
Who knows? People have done worse.
Rumor has it, too, that this is set up for a reality show. So we're just going to go ahead and dig right in.
So, starting in the seventh grade, apparently, they were each other's first kiss, Keith and Sherry, and they had little love notes going back and forth, which years later, he came across, supposedly.
He kept them for all these years.
And if he did, guys don't usually keep the notes, usually it's the girls,
that's
so it's
kind of
odd.
Psycho talk.
Yeah. Totally.
You know?
Crazy.
I mean, okay, some people could think it's romantic, some people could think it's creepy.
And, you know, some guys do.
Yeah.
Some guys do keep things like that, and it is romantic, or, you know.
But obviously, he was in love with her this entire time.
Yeah, exactly.
So then, let's talk about what happened in high school.
Yeah, which part? The 2003?
Yep.
Or the other one?
Well, let's just dive right into her best friend.
Yeah. Her best friend.
Because this is just too weird for me.
Yeah, and her best friend.
Tara Smith. 16 years old.
2 miles away from where Sherry was kidnapped.
Was also jogging.
Also kidnapped. Never to be seen again.
Never found. Now, let's just remind you, they were best friends. They went to high school, the same high school together. This is, to me, this is like, okay, Keith was around too, because they went to the same school. So he obviously is familiar with that, right?
Yeah, and it's a little odd that her best friend was missing.
Yeah.
And she was magically missing the same way. That doesn't make any sense. But no, who knows?
Doesn't.
I mean, stranger things have happened. You know, coincidences. Whatever.
Right. But it could also be a setup for...
hoax.
Right.
Get rich.
Exactly.
Get popular. You know, he worked at Best Buy as a tech, like a geek squad almost.
Yeah,
So, I mean, that can't make that much money.
No.
And for her to be a stay-at-home mom.
Right. And they're living in his family home, which his parents, I presume,
his parents,
either
I'm
passed
yeah.
or gave it to him. So I'm assuming it's paid off. Okay, but still, that's one income.
Yeah.
So that's got to be difficult. And everyone describes him as the perfect couple. Oh, they were just perfect for one another. It almost seems too perfect to me.
And even she described, we are the perfect couple and God must have just had his plan for us. Because obviously people know that she was previously married.
She was. So back to...
High school.
So then her best friend gets kidnapped, never to be seen again.
Who? Keith contacted her parents.
You're kidding.
Mm-mm. Yeah, he contacted their parents to ask about input.
When Sherry
regarding the yeah her being missing.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, he contacted them to see.
And that was in, correct me if I'm wrong, 2003?
No. That was 13 years ago. So, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wait, that's the year I graduated.
Oh, no, sorry. The 2003 the 13 years ago was the blog. The high school was 16 years ago.
Okay.
Right? 16 years. Or she was 16 years old.
So just starting from the beginning, because this blog, this skinhead blog, has become a huge thing in the case. Okay, was this why she was kidnapped?
Yeah.
So we're going to go ahead and read it to you because we found it and it's not easy to find and no one has really published it. So we're going to go ahead and read it to you. So bear with us.
To me, though, 13 years is kind of a long time to all of a sudden go, oh, this blog is
and then
up and now we're going to go kidnap her.
Right. So it's under her maiden name, which is Sherry Graeff.
Graeff?
G-R-A-E-F-F. And the name of it is Being Aware and Having Pride.
And this is on skinheads.com. Is it skinheads.com?
It's skinheads.com with a Z at the end.
And it's no longer, the website's no longer
it's
up,
taken
but there
down.
Is a link to this blog post in particular.
And we can provide a link on our Instagram page if people are interested or so forth. So here, I'm going to go ahead and read it. Now, please know, these are not my words. These are Sherry Papini's words.
And we do not share the same
thoughts
as her. This is just strictly
for research
from
only.
Her words.
So here it goes. I grew up in a small country town, Shasta Lake, California. My school was predominantly white. It was a small enough town that everyone pretty much knew each other. I was known as a really good athlete, and my dad had a reputation for being my biggest fan, but also for standing up against Latinos. He even was often kicked out of the stands for getting in fights and defending himself when the Latinos would call him a Nazi. Seems that our simply being of German descent was a constant irritant to them. I would get in fights, too. Having to stick up for myself instead of knuckling under to what the Latino girl said and wanted. I got excellent grades, 3.9 to 4.2, but I grew up more and more resentful of school and conditions around me. I used to come home in tears because I was getting suspended from school all the time for defending myself against the Latinos. The chief problem was that I was drug-free, white, and proud of my blood and heritage. This really irked a group of Latino girls, which would constantly rag and attack me. One night at my volleyball game, my homecoming game, I spotted the gang of Latinos sitting behind my father. As the game was coming to an end, I kept seeing my dad snap around and look behind him like he kept getting hit by something. Then I caught out of the corner of my eye that those little devils were throwing ice at my dad and mocking him by raising their hands in the air as if they were saluting Hitler. After the game was over and we shook hands with the other team, I walked up the bleachers towards my dad. Just at that moment, he turned around. I told the Latinos, nicely actually, to quit their acting up. Then one of them called me Hitler, unleashed a barrage of profanity against me and my dad, and took a swipe at me. That really teed me off. I don't think I've ever been that mad. I lunged back at her, slamming her head between the bleachers and pounding her face. It took 3 full-sized men to pull me off of her. I broke her nose, and I split her eyebrow. After that, they got out of the gym. I had to deal with the cops and such. She did not press charges, so I was released to my father's custody. Girls should not fight, which brings me to a point of why girls should not fight. We are just too fragile, and we break easily. I totally agree with skinheads that girls should not fight. They should stand by their men. But sometimes, I guess, you have to do what is necessary when a skinhead isn't on hand. On the way up the bleachers, when I had rebuffed the Latinos, I had split my leg open and it was hard for me to walk. But when my dad picked me up from the police department, the only thing he kept saying to me was, "Cher, I'm proud of you. You did the right thing. Keep on walking. Don't let your legs slow you down. Keep walking." It was a happy feeling to have such support from my dad. 2 weeks later, I was closing the family pizza joint we owned when 2 cars pulled up. I didn't even have to turn around to see who it was. I indistinctly knew who it was. 3 Latino guys and 5 girls rushed in and jumped me. I put up a fight, but I was clearly outnumbered and at a disadvantage. Jessie, the girl whose nose I broke, was with them. They kept hollering about how they hated skinheads and how all skinheads should be burned alive, and how my ancestors were supposedly all KKK. I actually laughed in their faces at the inaccuracy of their statements. I mean, they were so dumb that they actually were funny. How dumb can you be? There wasn't even a skinhead anywhere in sight. Then I got knocked to the floor and kicked in the face. I took a deep breath and shook my head in disbelief. Can this really be happening? I thought. Then I thought, is it worth it? Is being white and standing up for myself and my beliefs worth all this pain I'm having to put up with? I then heard the echo of my dad's voice. You did the right thing. Keep walking, Cher. I'm proud of you. It was that pride that gave me the will I needed right then and there. I took a deep breath, let out a cuss word, and got right back up, swinging. I don't ever swear like that. Not ever. But somehow the word just slipped out, just as Jesse kicked me in the stomach and the others hit me in the face a few times. Then, before I could even saw it coming, whack! One of them smashed me in the shin with a 2x4, fracturing my leg. But I kept fighting back so tenaciously that they saw they couldn't even defeat me. So they all suddenly ran out the door. My house was about 9 or 10 blocks away. I limped the entire way home. I'm not sure how I made it, but I still heard the sound of my dad's voice. Keep walking, Cher. Keep walking. I guess my point is that even though I didn't always understand why my life had to be one constant battle, our family values between myself and my dad carried me through. My dad was always there for me in spirit. Being white is more than being aware of my skin, but of standing behind skinheads who are always around in spirit as well, and having pride for my country. Being white is my family, my roots, my way of life. It's always there. There's no denying it. It's nobility. It's strength. It will be there to lift me up when I really need my pride, when I need to keep walking.
The end. That is the whole blog from Cheri, allegedly.
Allegedly.
And
it was 13 years ago.
Yeah, it was. That was
13 years ago.
Yeah.
But that was intense. I mean, if she really wrote that.
Yeah, and according to a Huffington Post written, which was before the 2020 came out.
Right. They said that they are familiar with the blog. We do not know if it has any relevance to the case or not. And the blog post was reportedly detailed racial abuse that the author claimed to suffer at the hands of Latinos, which is, of course, what we read. So after that, Cheri's married from 2006 to 2008 to her first husband, who is David Dreyfus, a platoon sergeant with the armed forces. According to the couple's marriage certificate obtained by People magazine, the pair divorced in September of 2008, according to the Shasta County Courthouse. And then Cheri moved back to Redding, and she ran into Keith, and the pair arranged a date.
Yeah, and Cheri had moved away and lost touch with Keith for several years before. She writes on the blog, but before she got married to the other guy.
Of course. So then in 2009, Cheri Grave becomes Cheri Papini after reconnecting and marrying her seventh grade sweetheart, Keith Papini. They settle into his parents' home in Redding, and they have two children. One boy, Tyler, who's 5 years old. One girl, Violet, who's 2 years old now. And Cheri is a stay-at-home mom. And Keith works at Best Buy as an audio-video specialist.
An ABC News exclusive tonight, the mystery of the mom who vanished while jogging.
November 2nd, 2016, Keith says that he leaves for work and he last saw Cheri getting Violet up for daycare. And sometime between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m., Cheri reportedly takes her phone and earbuds with her and goes for a jog in her neighborhood. At 5:50 p.m., Keith returns from work, and nor Cheri or the kids were at home. He looks around the house, and he goes into the different rooms. They're not there. So he calls daycare to see what time Cheri picked up the kids, and they said that the kids were still there, and Cheri never picked them up. And then that's when he knew something wasn't right. Her car was at the house, but she wasn't, and neither were the kids. So then Keith does the Find My Phone app, and it shows that her phone is about a mile away. He gets into Cheri's car to look for her using the app while it's pinging as he gets closer to the location. He finds her phone next to the mailbox with earbuds lying neatly on top with strands of blonde hair, presumably hers. He takes photos of the phone. He was said he was looking for Cheri, not the phone. Her husband, Keith, reported her missing the evening of November 2nd when he returned to their Mountain Gate home from work and discovered that she wasn't there. The cell phone, where we had just previously said by the mailbox, was near Sunrise Drive and Old Oregon Trail. He said it did somewhat appear to be that it was placed there purposely. The screen was facing up. So it was kind of interesting. So at that point, it's about 5:30 or 6 p.m., Keith calls the police to report his wife missing.
They've got 100 volunteers that day, people from the community, everyone's looking for her. A couple days later, Keith's given a lie detector test and he passes it. On November 10th, Keith does a story with People magazine pleading for her return. He says, just bring her home. Please bring her back. The sooner, the better.
Bring her home. Bring her home. Just bring her home. Bring her home safe. There's a $50,000 reward. Bring her home.
Keith said he was certain Sherry's vanishing was not voluntary. He said, she is my wife and I know everything about her. I know that my wife would never leave me and never in a million years would leave our kids.
To county authorities, we would greatly appreciate it.
We're going to put out a reward as soon as we can. And just everybody put your good thoughts out there, put your prayers out there, and let's find Sherry.
She was out for a run. This is very unlucky. She wouldn't leave her babies.
There's no way she would do anything to disrupt her children's routine. You know, being that the phone was found and she wasn't on her routine, there's no way she wouldn't have gone and picked up the children. They're on a very tight schedule, and she's extremely close with them. She's here with them every day, gardening and doing projects, and there's just no way that she would take off. It's terrible.
Sure.
I'm in a state of just being emotionalist so that we can do what needs to be done and take care of my brother.
What is her reaction to her phone being found on the ground?
I would say my personal reaction is that it's twofold. One is that it's good to have some sort of clue. The other portion is it really points to she's been taken. I mean, she wouldn't just drop her phone if she was running away. So at least it's giving us some kind of information, but we're sick. This is a pretty sickening situation.
She's very bubbly, friendly, has a great smile, absolutely loves her children, would do anything for them, just is beautiful and...
Yeah, she's an incredible human being. Best mom I've ever seen. I mean, her children, if you met her children, they're incredible. They're incredible because she's such a great mom. She's so hands-on. She really is the best mom I've ever seen. It's amazing. It's annoying because she's so amazing. We call her Super Mom. She's an amazing, beautiful light of a person.
You just want to find her.
Just bring Sherry home.
That was Keith and Sherry's sisters pleading for her safe return during a news conference. On November 24th, at around 4:30 a.m., Sherry is found. This is on Thanksgiving morning. She's spotted by a motorist on the side of I-5 about 150 miles away from Redding in Yolo County. Paramedics tell her, "Happy Thanksgiving." Sherry asks, "Is Thanksgiving night?" They told her it was Thanksgiving morning. She tells police that she was abducted and held captive by two adult Hispanic women, one with straight hair, one with curly hair, both of whom were armed, one with bushy eyebrows and one with thin eyebrows. According to the Huffington Post, Papini said her abductors were two armed Hispanic women in a dark sport utility vehicle. Papini described one of the suspects as having a thick accent, pierced ears, and thin eyebrows. The other suspect, she said, told police was older, with thick eyebrows and straight black hair. Authorities have yet to release a composite sketch of the suspects. Composite sketch of the suspects. We do not have any further description of the SUV or with the Hispanic females. That is information we got directly from Ms. Papini.
These Hispanic females are armed, considered dangerous, and they have a handgun. Keith said, "My first sight was my wife in a hospital bed, her face covered in bruises ranging from yellow to black because of repeated beatings, the bridge of her nose broken." Keith Papini said this in a statement to ABC's Good Morning America. Her now emaciated body of 87 pounds was covered in multicolored bruises, severe burns, red rashes, and chain markings. Her signature long blonde hair had been chopped off. She has been branded, and I could feel the rise of her scabs under my fingers. And before he had went in, the police had told him, you know, braced him, but she's alive.
On November 29th, in a story that broke on in People magazine by Allison Sutton, the woman who called 911 after seeing Sherry on the roadway told People magazine that the missing woman was looking panicked and frightened. I saw this woman with long blonde hair in the right shoulder of the freeway. She was waving a piece of fabric that looked like a shirt, waving it up and down, trying to flag someone down. Allison Sutton said it was obvious that she needed help. Keith also releases a statement to People describing Sherry's conditions upon her release, how her accused captors beat, branded, and starved her. He also did an interview with 2020, which I'm sure some of you have seen. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend you watch it. It was an excellent episode.
It was. It was a very informative episode. You can see
it's a mystery.
Keith talking, and just the way he looks, as he's crying and looking down. It's definitely interesting.
You we'd never love to see hear, Sherry.
No, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on the 2020 case.
Yeah.
When you watch it, and you can email us at thetwogirlstruecrime@gmail.com, and the two is spelled T-W-O. It's not the number two. Start to want an empty, but you can't be sure. Please tell me I'm broken. It's much easier that way. Cause I just let you down. It's much easier that way. I'm nothing but a low life. Still just a low life. I can't help myself.
Now to the mystery surrounding the disappearance of that California mom. Another young woman who attended the same high school also vanished years ago while jogging. ABC's Matt Gutman joins us from Los Angeles with the new details. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Robin. The similarities at first rattled law enforcement. 18 years before Sherry Papini's story would captivate the country, Tara Smith, who had the same look, also disappeared while out for a jog in the same town. But the biggest difference, in Tara Smith's case, police had a person of interest. As investigators continue to scour Northern California for those who abducted Sherry Papini, they're haunted by another young woman's unsolved disappearance. 16-year-old Tara Smith vanished in 1998.
And so was that kind of in your head? Oh, man, I hope this is not another case of a complete disappearance.
Absolutely it was, and it was on the investigators' minds. In fact, there is a resemblance of Tara Smith and Ms. Papini, which made it maybe even a little bit more eerie.
This is the two of them side by side. Both were out jogging when they vanished. Both went to the same high school at the same time in the 1990s. Sherry even auditioned for the same role as Tara's sister in this fifth grade play. And both cases captivated the city of Redding, California. But there are glaring differences.
She and Keith have been reunited.
Sherry was released weeks after her abduction.
I just ran past everybody and throw open the curtain, and she was there in a bed, and her poor face. And I just hugged her. I just held her. I felt like I hugged her for like 20 minutes.
But unlike Keith Papini, Terry Smith and his family never got that Thanksgiving Day miracle.
Brought back a lot of the memory of those initial days.
And also, unlike the Papinis, Smith believes he knows what happened to his daughter.
We've known since the very first night.
While no one was ever named as a suspect in Tara's disappearance, Terry Smith has long suspected a local man. Terry Smith says Keith sought out his advice as he grappled with Sherry's disappearance.
He wanted to know just how to get by day to day, and then also dealings with law enforcement.
And in many ways, Keith is taking that advice. Keith has what he calls an A-team, friends who say they've set up a war room and continue to run a shadow investigation to find the abductors who are still out there. As for the man Terry Smith still believes killed his daughter, He's never been charged and continues to live in Reading. Now, while some of the similarities are uncanny, investigators tell us right now the two cases are not related. Guys.
Okay, Matt, we're going to talk more about that with ABC News.
We're back now to talk about the missing person case of Tara Smith, who happened to be Sherry Papini's friend in high school. We found the following information on Reddit. A pretty 16-year-old homecoming queen named Tara Smith disappeared on August 22, 1998, and has never been found. Tara was a popular athletic teenager attending Central Valley High School in a safe and tight-knit community in Northern California's Shasta County.
On the evening of August 22nd, Tara informed her parents that she was going running, and she headed out from the family's rural home at about 6 p.m. What Tara did not tell her parents was that she called her martial arts instructor, Troy Zink, and asked him to meet her. It was after Tara vanished that her parents discovered their 16-year-old daughter was romantically involved with the then 29-year-old married father, Zink. While desperately searching through her room, her parents discovered letters from Zink that he had written their daughter. When they read through her diary, they also found a young girl's account of her relationship with a man that they trusted who appeared to have taken advantage of their daughter and his role in the teacher-student relationship. The most troubling entries in Tara's timeline were those written in the few weeks leading up to her disappearance. Her feelings for Zink had changed. The final journal entries detailed her plans to end her relationship with him and even included her plan to arrange a meeting time during their regular evening jog.
Regular evening jog. Sounds kind of planned to me. While working on securing search warrants, investigators brought Zink in for questioning. It would be the one and only time they would ever get to interview the martial arts teacher about Tara's disappearance.
Wow.
Shaking my head. Zink denied any involvement in her disappearance and maintained that there were no inappropriate or illegal relationship between him and Tara. He told investigators that Tara called him at work from her cell phone and asked him to meet. He claimed that when they met, Tara asked him for $2,000, but said she didn't tell him what she needed the money for. Zink said he refused to help her, which made Tara very angry. Next, he said Tara asked him to drop her off at a random intersection, nowhere near her home.
Oh, come on.
Mm-hmm. He agreed, and according to him, Tara walked off uneventfully. The married father told deputies that afterwards he decided to drive to an area east of the Lake Shasta Dam called Hang Glider Hill. So, he could pray.
Okay.
Pray.
Okay. It goes on to say that the Hang Glider Hill is only accessible by private roads that are closed off by locked gates. Contractors and several local hang gliders have keys to the steel gate that blocks the most accessible road to the peak, and both said there was no way he was up there. Moreover, they said not only was it blocked, but there was a caregiver on hand during that time frame who had not seen Zink make the 2-plus-hour drive up the steep road. I'm sorry, but are you going to drive 2 hours to go up somewhere to pray?
There's plenty of beautiful areas where you could get to in Shasta Lake.
If you wanted to go pray
by a lake.
But, I mean, it sounds to me like he either dumped her body up there, mm-hmm. or he dumped her body somewhere else and then went up there to pray because he felt...
They didn't see him, so maybe he was trying to use that
as an alibi.
Oh, if I was up there, then search over there.
There's...
Instead of searching...
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
To throw them off.
Yeah, throwing them off the trail.
Okay, so they go on to say that investigators knew Zink had arrived home shortly after 11 p.m. and Tara had last been seen around 6 p.m. So it could not possibly, he could not have possibly have met with her, as he said, and then ascended the steep road 2 hours to prey on the mountain's peak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see?
Deputy deputy searched that entire area of Hang Glider Hill, and Tara was never found.
Yeah, and the investigators searched Zink's home, truck, and martial arts studio with sealed warrants. Evidence was found, but since the warrants were sealed, the information was never made public. Whatever it was, wasn't enough to tie him to Tara's disappearance. However, during their extensive searches, they turned up an arsenal of guns. In total, 7 guns were found, which meant the convicted felon was in violation of California's law prohibiting felons from possessing firearms. An arrest warrant was issued, and Zink, who had served just over a year in a California state prison after he pleaded guilty to rape in 1991.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Was taken into custody. Unbelievably, Zink had many vocal supporters in the community, along with his wife and family. So while Zink refused to talk to investigators about Tara, members of the community declared his innocence in the media. Now, I don't get that.
Why people support
him? I mean, yeah, I mean...
Well, I think he had them all fooled. He's a martial arts teacher, and, you know, and he's married with 2 kids, and I bet he had everyone fooled.
And how many other people did he rape that haven't come forward?
That's another very good point. If he's messing around with a 16-year-old, I'm sure there's many other girls that he also had.
Kids, it's just like when the community with the priests who trust, kids trust them.
Right.
And
the community trusts
them. The community trusts them. And of course, you know, he's a martial arts teacher, so he's trusted. Yep. He has a studio.
Yep.
You know, it's like, we're safe to have them go there.
Right. It's awful. Just awful. It goes on to say investigators continue to search for Tara, following up on leads and exploring any other possibilities, all while working on their case against the individual they believe that was guilty of her disappearance. While awaiting sentencing, Zink and his wife permanently closed his business. Tara's family stood at the front of the long line of people wanting to witness Zink's sentencing. What they hadn't expected was the line of people wanting to witness Zink's sentencing. What they hadn't expected was the hundreds of community members all wearing yellow ribbons in Tara's honor who stood behind them in the long, winding line.
Winding line. Here's a side note. Sherry, what does that say? Also had yellow ribbons worn in their search efforts. Sherry Papini, and they also had the yellow ribbons on the trees.
And it says, one woman told reporters that members of the community had planned to attend and display their ribbons to let Terry and Marilyn Smith know that the larger community stood behind them.
Zink was brought into court wearing his jail-issued clothing, and he sat emotionless.
He's a sociopath.
Yep. Or a psychopath, as Tara's family and their supporters looked on. The judge sentenced Zink to 4 years without the possibility of parole, to be followed by 3 years of supervised probation.
That's it.
Yep.
Well, with no body.
But they didn't.
There's no.
Yeah. Too bad they couldn't get more. I mean, the felony with the guns and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Yeah.
Zink's wife, of course, cried out loud as she listened, while Tara's family, surrounded by their supporters, seemed pleased that the judge ignored Zink's arguments for a light sentence. I'm glad.
Yeah.
Too bad. I mean, and the thing is, with the law,
so awful.
There's so many rules with the law, and a lot of them are still a little bit older. So, you know, it's hard to get the stuff that they actually should have.
Yeah. It's easy to see why Tara's parents and investigators and many others don't believe Zink's story.
Yeah. And I am also wondering right now, another side note, Here's a side note.
Hashtag side note.
Hashtag here's a side note. I don't understand how he has a martial arts business that deals with children when
he has a rape charge
and he's a convicted felon. You can't have guns.
So he must have hit that somehow. Or they didn't. How did that happen?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
It's a business.
That is scary, isn't it?
Yeah, so I'm wondering. I mean, now that was 1998.
But that's a really good point.
That was 20 years ago.
Maybe they check a little better.
But
maybe
still,
do better
it's like
background checks now. But that's so scary.
But also, 1998 was still a little more. You know, it was more in the times than you know the 50s or 60s.
Totally.
So,
wow.
I don't know. That's just a question of mine.
Well, it's been 18 years, and there's been no arrest or body found. Terry Smith says that he knows his daughter is dead, and he knows what happened to her. He added that while time has dulled the unbearable pain of the first several years, nothing has lessened the anger and frustration with the lack of justice.
Shasta County Sheriff Sergeant John Hubbard shares Terry Smith's frustration with the case and says he feels awful for Tara's parents, adding that if he could solve one case, this would be it. A few tips still come in every year, and he follows up on each of them, but nothing has panned out.
Do you think Zink gamed the system? Is he guilty but smart enough to cover his tracks? All roads seem to lead to Zink, but where is Tara's body? Tara had no history of troubles or running away, but is it plausible that she did? If so, why would she leave everything behind and never contact her family again? Prior to her disappearance, she always maintained a close and loving relationship with her parents and her three siblings. Wow. So what are your thoughts about Tara? Do you think that Zink did it, or do you think that she ran away?
I think that, no, if she ran away, she would have turned up. I mean, 16-year-olds that run away turn up somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, the cops would have found leads if she would have ran
away.
She
didn't bring anything with her.
And if you were going to run away when you're 16, a lot
you're
of times
go out
they
for
turn
a jog.
In. Well, I mean, they could think you're jogging, but no, you're not going to go out for a jog.
With nothing on
and
you.
And you would, you know, a lot of the times, unfortunately, people will turn it to prostitution and stuff for money.
Of course.
And she, we're not saying she did that at all, but that she would have been found if that would have happened.
If that was the case.
You know, so.
So he killed her and he put her body somewhere where, you know, she'll never, it could be at Shasta Lake for all
anyone
knows.
And he still lives in Redding.
Yep.
So what if.
What if.
What if.
He was part of the Sherry Papini case.
But what if she's still alive?
Well, that would be, you mean like he's keeping her
Yeah, like that gal who was
Degard,
and then those kids over
the three girls in Cleveland.
In Cleveland, which we're going to do those cases in another episode.
Yes, we will be talking about that, yeah.
But, I mean, it's been a long time, almost 20 years, but, I mean, that could be a possibility.
Well, J.C. Degard was held for, wasn't she held for...
16 or 18.
Exactly.
Yeah, for a long time.
I mean, if this guy was so in love with her, and she tried to end things.
Yeah,
he could have. He could have just taken her and put her somewhere. Mm-hmm. And oh my God, that's a scary thought, isn't it?
And you know, maybe she, you know, still lives somewhere in the area with him. Nobody knows who she is. She doesn't leave the house. She's held captive.
Well, like
or
in,
she
in
did
that
die.
Other, like in the other case, the wife helped. Remember?
Yeah.
In the J.C.
Oh, yeah.
Was that J.C. Degard?
Degard, yeah, that
yeah,
was creepy.
Yeah, where the wife helped, and she had the three children, and all
she
his,
helped deliver
and,
them
oh,
and stuff.
Oh, God, I mean, it's like, I can't even imagine.
No, that's so gross.
But to our listeners, if you have any info regarding this case, please go to the Crime Stoppers and report anything, if you have any information leading to Tara's disappearance.
Yeah, you know, these days with the internet, it's been really great for... You know, people come with evidence.
Come forward with
they find things, info, or it's a fresh mind.
Mm-hmm.
A fresh mind will help say, hey, what about the thoughts on maybe this fire trail up here in Shasta? And then that's what leads to the finding of the body, you know?
Right.
Things like that with the Crime Stoppers. There's a lot of internet people out there helping.
I have to say, we grew up in a small town, and in a small town, you hear things. So maybe somebody in Reading will hear our podcast and come forward. I would just, all I hope for Terry and Marilyn Smith is that they find their daughter's body, because there is nothing worse
than not being able
to put her to rest.
Closure.
Right.
Knowing what happened, not wondering every day if, okay, is she still alive? Right. Am I going to see her again? What does she look
torture.
Like?
That's torture. I mean, is she that's being just tortured?
Because the parents are being tortured.
Right.
You know, it would be nice. Okay. It would be nice to have this case closed.
Yes, it would be.
We thank you for listening to today's episode. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed recording it for you. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
We'd love to hear from you with any ideas or input for future episode topics. You can do this by emailing us at twogirlstruecrime, that's twogirlstruecrime@gmail.com. And then you can also follow us on Instagram at twogirlstruecrime. We look forward to hearing from you.
The first 5 emails we receive, those listeners will get a shout out on our next episode. See you then. Miss Holly,
Miss Haven,
signing off.